Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the House Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today is March 5th, Super Tuesday. So anybody who wants to vote in a presidential primary, today's your last opportunity to do that in Minnesota. So polls are open till 8, so I understand. So we have first order business. A quorum is present, and approval of the minutes.
Madam Chair,
Representative Bierman.
I make a motion to approve the minutes of February 29th, please.
Thank you. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. So the first bill on the agenda, before we get to the agenda, I just would like to ask folks in the room to please be seated. I know there are a lot of people standing. There's a lot of interest in the bills today, but I really would like to see folks sitting down rather than standing along the back wall on both sides. So please, if you can, there do appear to be seats. We're all friends. People, please move in so that there's room on the ends of the aisles. Pretend you're on an airplane. It's okay to sit next to somebody. You might have more room than on an airplane. All right. Thank you. Thank you for making that effort, folks. Okay. All right. The first bill on the agenda is House File 4484. Since Representative Howard is not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 4484 be re-referred to Ways and Means. So with that, Representative Howard. Oh, you have an amendment. We should take up the amendment first. Yes. Thank you. So there is an A1 amendment to put the bill in the order in which the author would like to discuss it. So the chair will move the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So Representative Howard, to your bill as amended.
Chair Liebling, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill. And I'm going to start with a little history that a lot of folks might remember, but we have newer folks that might not remember it. So in 2020, the Minnesota legislature passed the Alex Smith Insulin Affordability Act. This law was spearheaded by a group of Minnesota advocates and Nicole and James Holt in the wake of the loss of Alex Smith, who aged off his parents' insurance and died rationing his insulin because he couldn't afford it. He couldn't afford to pay for it because three insulin manufacturers had cornered the market and raised the price by more than 1,200%. Together with Nicole and James, we set out to pass a law that said in Minnesota, never again. Never again would someone lose their life because they couldn't afford the insulin they need to survive. And we passed a bill on a bipartisan basis that many other states have sought to replicate. Since passing our law, more than 2,000 Minnesotans have used Alex's law to gain access to affordable insulin when they needed it most. This is literally a life-saving law here in Minnesota, and as I mentioned, other states are looking to make progress on the same very issue. There are two ways that Minnesotans can access insulin under Alex's law: an emergency program, where folks who are facing an emergent need for insulin can access it at a pharmacy for $35 for a 1 or 2 month supply. Additionally, there is a long-term program where applicants can be matched up with patient assistant programs from the manufacturers to access insulin for up to 12 months. In the law we passed, we said, let's do some reporting. Let's understand the utilization of this program and come back in a few years to assess whether there is still a need for the long-term program. In your packet, you'll see that the Board of Pharmacy, or in your emails, the Board of Pharmacy has completed these reports year after year. And unequivocally, the answer is yes, we should continue this life-saving program because Minnesotans are still using it. While more Minnesotans are using the emergency program, we are still seeing that Minnesotans are benefiting from the long-term program, which again can be life-saving and budget-stabilizing for families when they need it most. And as a reminder how this program is structured, it's the insulin manufacturers that are responsible for covering the cost of the insulin. So this bill before you, after its amendment, will have no cost to the state. Members, on a bipartisan basis, the legislature took the right action when we created Alex Law. Today, the right action is to make sure this program continues to provide potentially life-saving medications to Minnesotans when they need it. With that, I'll turn it to my testifier.
All right. Thank you, Representative Howard. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Nicole Smith-Holt, and as Representative Howard said, I am the mother of Alex Smith, who unfortunately passed away from rationing his insulin. And I'm here just to remind you all that, you know, this was a safety net in place for people who are in an emergency situation or encounter long-term financial struggles affording their life-saving insulin. You know, I get contacted on a regular basis from people in dire straits, dire situations, wanting to know what they can do to afford their insulin, because it's still unaffordable, no matter what the pharmaceutical industry will lead you to believe. With their creation of patient assistance programs, people are still struggling. People are still unable to access those patient assistance programs that they claim that they have set up and altered and made more easily available to people. It's still, there's still barriers in place. There's still struggles. People are still rationing their insulin. The pharmaceutical industry will say that they have capped the cost of insulin, but that's just not accurate. People are still going to the pharmacy and still paying hundreds or thousands of dollars. So I just urge you all to keep this program in place. Keep people alive, basically. It's needed. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify on this bill? All right, seeing none, member discussion. All right, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Howard. We worked together on this years ago. I actually was... it's interesting. We put this into place after the manufacturers actually had already put it into place. The manufacturers had already done all of these things. And so I'm wondering, we're hearing that folks are still unable to access this. People are still rationing. People are still paying for thousands of dollars for their insulin. Can you talk to us about that? Do you have examples of that? And you know, I mean, is it a certain population with which that's happening? Is that in the fully insured market? Where is that happening? And why? Why is that still happening? Because these programs are all available. So why is that still happening?
Representative Howard.
Chair Liebing, Representative New Brindley, and Nicole could maybe answer even better than me, but specifically with the patient assistance programs, what we heard back in 2019 and 2020, over and over again from Minnesotans with type 1 diabetes is these programs themselves are not very accessible. You know, everything from getting denied to waiting on hold for any kinds of number of reasons. And when you talk to Minnesotans that experience these programs, they were left with the impression that they were sort of designed to be complicated. Now, under our law, folks get connected with a navigator, a MinSure navigator, who can help kind of navigate some of these processes to help folks access what program might make sense for them. And so in that way, this law is creating structures to make programs that might exist be more accessible for Minnesotans.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that, you know, I mean, I'm reading in the amendment to the amendment that you have removed training navigators as part of this appropriation. That's no longer a requirement. And you've extended the deadline. How has that appropriation been used so far, and how much is left? Because you've extended that deadline significantly. It wasn't that big of an appropriation. What has it been used for if not to train the navigators?
Representative Howard.
Chair Liebing, I might ask someone from Insure to answer that, but as I understand, they have been using it to train navigators, but just have been judiciously using state resources and haven't utilized all that. And so this amendment would just sort of create a little flexibility for MNSHR.
Do you want to bring up the MNSHR person, Representative New Brindley?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Probably not. I mean, we're being told that it's for navigators, but they're not actually. I mean, we've gave this funding to train navigators, and that's not where it's going. You know, I remain frustrated that, you know, we are doing something that makes us feel good that insurance companies are already doing. They've already capped all insulin. Manufacturers are doing it. I mean, these are manufacturer programs that existed before this legislation. And so it just feels, once again, like this legislation makes us feel good, but it's probably not necessary. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, so I'm going to have the MNSHR person come down, please, and respond, because I don't want to just leave that hanging out there. And let's get the accurate information. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Hi, my name is Erica Helvick Anderson. I'm the Senior Director of Public Affairs for MNSHR. The change in the amendment was just to give a little bit more flexibility in some of the spending, so it'll still be used for training navigators as appropriate. The original appropriation, there was just, you know, we try to be good stewards of dollars, and there was some money left, and we want to make sure instead of asking for another appropriation, we could use the flexibility instead of putting a fiscal note on this one.
All right, thank you. Okay, next we have Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. An observation, probably more than a question, but one of the questions that's been raised is, you know, why is it still so hard for people to obtain the low-cost version of drugs like insulin? One of the reasons, and it's very well documented right at this point, is that we're in cases where manufacturers are offering both a high price and a low price version of a brand drug. In many cases, the plans through their PBMs are choosing the high price drug because they want the rebates more than they want the lower prices for the patients. And so I've been working on related legislation, but again, it's only because of laws like Alex's law that the plans and the PBMs are being required to make the low cost version of the drugs available.
Thank you. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My question, because deals with accessibility, how will then this, I have a family member who's a pharmacist, and I know how hard that, my daughter's pharmacy works to make sure people get the drugs and everything. So they're very responsive. So the challenge I have, and I'll just say it point blankly, I've never seen government do a better job than the private industry. I'm sorry, I've never seen that. So, and I respect what you're trying to do, you know, in regards with, but how does this make it easier for people to get insulin when I know that people come in if they need it, they'll find a way to help these folks. So there just seems an oxymoron here. Help me out to explain that process, please.
So I see you both kind of want to jump in there.
Thank you.
Ms. Smith-Holt,
I would love to comment on that. You know, the pharmaceutical industry is a for-profit industry. Our healthcare system is a for-profit industry. If my son walked into a pharmacy and did not have insurance and was asked to pay $1,300. Who, at 26 years old, has $1,300 that they can just say, here, this is what I need to stay alive per month? It happens on an everyday basis to people. There are people that are underinsured and uninsured. My 26-year-old should not have died because he did not have $1,300 in his bank account. And our healthcare system is set up to make it more difficult for people to access affordable medications. The pharmaceutical industries, they have done a lot, but it's only because we are outraged. And there is no law in place to prevent them next month from saying no more patient assistance programs. We need this law in place so that next month, next year, there's a safety net for people. So we are not burying more people because they can't afford what keeps them alive.
Thank you, Ms. Smith-Holt. You know, I think it might be helpful. Just, I know not everybody knows you other than what you've just told us. And I know you are very much still in touch with the community of people who depend on these programs. I just wish, could you just describe that really briefly? Because I think it's important for people to know that you have a basis for understanding, like, what's going on out there.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm the ambassador for T1 International, which is a global advocacy working at the grassroots level to make access to affordable insulin for all. This is an epidemic in the United States where our healthcare system is failing us. I also am part of the Minnesota Insulin for All chapter, where we have thousands of members. Many of them are uninsured or underinsured. And they are struggling on a daily basis. People are reaching out to me. I have a refrigerator full of insulin that has been donated to me by people that have passed away that I have to forward on to those that are on death's door. It's a problem, and it's something that Minnesota has worked really, really, really hard to curb in Minnesota, and other states have replicated our bill as well. You know, we are working at the federal level. We're working very hard at the federal level because ultimately what we need to do is cap the cost of insulin. You know, many states have capped a copay, and that's great for those who have the luxury of having insurance, but many people don't have insurance. And those are the people that are falling through the cracks. Those are the people that are ending up in ICU, in diabetic ketoacidosis, and costing the state thousands of dollars to try to prevent their deaths and treating their long-term health conditions as a result of what their body has gone through when they've gone into DKA from not having their insulin.
All right, thank you. Representative Perryman.
One quick question. Thank you, Chair and Howard, Representative Howard. My question is, we talked about navigators and contacting them and how they're associated to this. How do you get informed, or how do you contact a navigator and find out and reach out to them? Because it sounds like a very helpful tool, but not sure how that works.
Representative Howard.
Chair Liebling, Representative Perryman, it's a good question. I'm going to, in a way, kind of answer Representative Backer's question, too, about pharmacies, because often folks' first point of contact is at a pharmacy. And we work very closely with our pharmacists in crafting this bill. And so often it's the pharmacist who can help figure out for a patient if they would qualify, you know, right there if they need an emergent need, fill an emergent supply. But provide the kind of information they need to see if they need access or could be a fit for the long-term program. Minsure has also done its own sort of proactive work in sort of messaging and marketing to try to make sure that folks know. So we've got a kind of a multi-step way, but I think of it often as it's somebody showing up at the pharmacy. They're in tough straits. And that's a point of information to see how we can help folks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Howard. I think it'd be a really great branding or messaging to get that out there, too, so that everyone knows. I know the pharmacists are kind of full up on their plates already, but I would like to see that happen, too. Thank you.
All right. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I want to thank you, Ms. Smith, for being here today and continuing this fight, which has gone on and on and on and will continue until we make the changes we need to see in our medical system and pharmaceuticals particularly. But you are a champion. You are just the person we need to hear from. And just want to thank you for the education you've given me over the years. And keep up the fight. That's what we have to do. And Representative Howard, you were first bringing this one to the docket as sort of the example what's wrong with our pharmaceutical industry. And here, after years, it's still just as hard to navigate and to make change. But until we all around this table and in this state and in this nation can come to the realization that everybody should be able to afford the drugs they need to live, we won't get the changes we need, so we need to keep working at the state level, bubble it up to the federal, and make the change we need in medications with, I mean, what works around the world is regulation of price. It does not impinge upon research It might impinge upon drug advertising on TV. It might impinge upon some of the lobbyist expenses for pharmaceutical industries, but we can keep up quality and research and lower price at the same time. So thanks for your work on this.
All right, final closing word, really brief, Representative Howard.
Chair Liebling, I will be brief because I think Ms. Smith-Holt, I couldn't say it any better than she did about why this bill is important. The only thing I want to say is we have made progress since we passed this bill in 2020, and it's solely because of the advocacy of Nicole, James, and Minnesotans and folks with type 1 diabetes all across the country. You know, our $35 standard for emergency insulin that we set, that has become the national standard because of our advocacy here. These in pharma companies, they didn't pick $35 out of the goodness of their hearts. They picked it because of the public pressure and rooms like this that say never again. And so that's why this bill is important. We need to continue moving forward, and that's what this bill represents. So thank you for the time.
All right. Well, thank you both for being here today and bringing the bill. So I'm going to renew my motion that House File 4484, as amended, be re-referred to Ways and Means. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No. Aye.
The motion prevails, and the bill is going to Ways. Thank you very much. Okay, the next bill on the agenda is House File 3700, Representative Smith. And we did sort of begin the hearing on this bill on a previous day, but we ran out of time, and so we took some testimony on it. But so Representative Smith is going to move that House File 3700 be laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Smith, maybe you want to just give us a little recap and get us oriented. So, to your bill.
Absolutely, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee for allowing one of my testifiers who had flown in to testify to give that last week, and I'm glad we'll have some more time to talk about it here. There is an unfortunate trend, and it's not just here in Minnesota, it's across the country, of rural hospitals or healthcare clinics, birthing centers, closing down or being consolidated into off-site healthcare facilities or larger healthcare facilities. By my count, there have been 11 since October of last year. So in about 4 months, there's been 11. And it's all over the state, from New Prague to Fergus Falls, Boston to New Ulm. So it's affecting a lot of our constituents. The intent of this bill is not to stop that process. That is a larger problem that I think all of us in this room are working on in various ways. Rather, this bill is focused on bringing some sort of clarity and transparency to that process and to empower those local communities where those closures happen in the tragic event that that closure must take place. So this bill does those two things, and this is how it does it. So first, to offer transparency and clarity, this bill gives clear and strict timeline that hospitals, healthcare systems need to use when they are removing those services that they had previously offered. It also specifies who should receive that information. I won't go through the specifics. You can find that in the bill. The other really main focus of this bill is to empower those local communities. I think this enhanced timeline also does that, giving them time to respond if they think it is unjust to try to stop the closure or to adjust their own plans for future care if that closure is going to take place. The bill also requires that a public hearing, which is already required by law currently, happens physically in the community where that closure is taking place, so those people can have a face-to-face interaction and understand why that potentially is going to happen. The bill also gives a right of first refusal to local government units or the state in the case that a whole hospital has to be sold. And so, again, giving opportunities for local units of government to respond accordingly how they see fit when these closures happen. That is, I know, a very brief overview, but that's the basics of the bill, and I do think we have testifiers for this bill here today, Chair.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Smith. So first on our list of testifiers is Brittany Livacari, and then Justin Stofron, and then Mary Krenke. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you. My name is Brittany Livacari.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of this committee. As I said, my name is Brittany Livercary. I'm a registered nurse at United Hospital in the Emergency Department. I have 19 years of experience in nursing. Like at other hospitals, nurses at United have experienced the brunt end of what happens when we fail to have, as a state and a society, a functioning system to deliver mental health and chemical dependency services to those who need them. As the mental health crisis has surged in our state, so too has the hospital boarding crisis, which I know many members of this committee have already heard about and will continue to hear about as it greatly affects our community. Unfortunately, instead of working to increase access to mental health services, massive healthcare corporations in our state continue to slash the services that executives deem to be a drain on their bottom line. It is well known that in our eastern metropolitan community, access for mental health care has reached critical mass. Recently, Allina has made the decision to close adolescent mental health at United Hospital. A community needs assessment created by Allina for United Healthcare, United Hospital, defined access for mental health inpatients and outpatients as the number one issue for the Eastern Metro community. Closing available beds in this most vulnerable population and shifting services out of the community despite ongoing known crisis puts a further toll on our communities. Again, they did this despite knowing the need in our community. They closed this unit in September. It was a 15-bed mental health unit. They did this under the guise of being a relocation of services, not a closure, even though the beds that were supposedly being relocated all the way across the metro at Abbott Northwestern clearly is not in our same community. What happened at Abbott was the creation of 6 swing beds that could be either for adults or adolescents. Not both. We don't mix those patients. If an adult is in one of those beds, all 6 are adult beds. If an adolescent is in the bed, then all 6 are adolescents. Now, I'm not a mathematician, but I do know that 6 is definitely less than 15. So it was a closure of beds.
Okay. I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
Yes, ma'am. We do need more accountability. While, as said, it doesn't solve the issues leading to these closures, it will at least bring much-needed transparency. As an ER nurse and a mother, I've experienced dealing with the lack of adolescent mental health beds and services available in the state. I'm acutely aware of how this negatively impacts our family and our entire community to have reliable resources when we need them. My child recently suffered from suicidal ideation. We experienced what others have had. We boarded in an emergency room for several days, and we did not receive care, only an attempt to keep my child safe. We were transferred to Brooklyn Park to get the care we need. And now, luckily, as a family, we were able to sustain those resources, but many aren't. Alina's ability to violate this law without any repercussions should be a cause for action. And this is just one example. Patients, taxpayers, and the public in generally deserve more of these hospitals' little transparency in what they are making on the decisions. Please bring transparency and accountability to the process by supporting House File 3700. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Justin Stofron, and then Mary Krinke, and then we have Abby Loesch. Welcome to the committee. We need to please be brief if you can.
Yep. Thank you, Chair Liebling and committee members. My name is Justin Stofron, and I'm the Anti-Monopoly Director at the Minnesota Farmers Union, and appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3700 today. At our most recent annual convention in November, MFU members voted to make ensuring affordable and accessible care in rural Minnesota as a top priority. House File 3700 will advance that mission by helping address a key consequence of hospital and health system consolidation, which is the closure of hospitals and the loss of critical health care services in communities. We've submitted a letter to the committee with all sorts of facts and numbers. It's good bedtime reading. But I wanted to focus on a couple of stories and thoughts from our members who couldn't be here today. Ann Schwagel is MFU's vice president and farms in Big Stone County with her young family. And between that county and the neighboring county, there's only one hospital providing OB care. As Ann has testified to the legislature before, quote, it is difficult to raise a family and ensure the next generation of family farmers in rural Minnesota if there's nowhere to deliver babies. Dr. Dana Seifert and her husband farm in Scott County, and Dr. Seifert is a physical therapist at an independent clinic in St. Peter. In her decade of experience in healthcare, she's seen firsthand the impact of consolidation on our healthcare system. She has said in testimony, quote, Minnesota will be better served by a larger fleet of right-sized healthcare organizations, not a dwindling number of lumbering behemoths with too many layers of management between the people making decisions up in the C-suites and the providers on the front line serving patients. House File 3700 offers a chance for communities to protect and control local healthcare infrastructure and take steps to fulfill the vision laid out by Dr. Seifert. Members, 3 decades ago, Minnesotans spent below the national average on hospital care for a system that was less consolidated, more distributed, and provided greater access. Today, Minnesotans spend more than the national average for a more highly consolidated system with less access. House File 3700 is one part of reversing this trend. I want to thank Representative Smith for his leadership in bringing this bill forward, and thank the committee again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Mary Krenke, she's waited long to testify on this. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Mary Krenke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I want the committee to understand that the last thing that a board of directors of a hospital wants to do is to close the hospital. This is really hard on the numerous patients, their employees, and for the larger community which the hospital is located. Service line closures are not necessarily permanent and can reflect changes in the needs of the community. I just want to lay out the top three reasons why service line changes happen. Number one, patient safety and quality. Number two, budget challenges that the hospital may have with that particular service line. And number three, workforce shortages. And what usually will happen is the community cannot recruit a psychiatrist or an OBGYN. I just want to give one example of what has recently happened in Fergus Falls. The hospital there had employed psychiatrists on staff prior to 2022, and that was when the last psychiatrist retired. And at that point in time, they contracted with the local physician group, the Fergus Falls Healthcare Medical Group, and just at the end of the year, last year, 2023, they informed the hospital that they would no longer be providing inpatient mental health services. So the hospital then quickly has been trying to recruit psychiatrists to no success. And so the hospital made the decision that on March 15th, when the provider group is no longer providing services to the hospital, they have to close their inpatient mental health unit. I use this example because frequently service line closures are due to the fact that the hospital cannot recruit a specific provider group. And the law as it is written now allows for those examples. I just want to also thank Representative Smith for changing the original bill from 300 days to 182 days for the closure notification and the service line closure. This is a step in the right direction. I do want people to understand that if a hospital is going to close, staff is going to start leaving. So this is not a situation where the hospital necessarily wants to stop providing services, but if they announce 6 months in advance that they're going to close, staff is going to start looking for other jobs, and you can't blame them. I know I'm out of time, but I do want to mention two other parts of the bill. The financial penalties section of the bill, there are 19 new requirements for hospitals to post different notifications and things. These are not all bad. We would actually support many of them. But there's a $20,000 penalty for each time the hospital fails to do something. It looks like it's collective rather than just one fine. In closing, we're very concerned about the right of first refusal. This would actually slow the process down, and many times a hospital could merge with a larger system. And I know there's bias against larger systems, but sometimes that's the only option that a small hospital has to stay open. It might be in the community's best interest to keep the hospital open rather than the option of first refusal. Mergers do help some small hospitals stay open. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. And Abby Loesch. Welcome to the committee.
Ready? Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Abby Loesch, and I am here today on behalf of the Minnesota Business Partnership, which represents many of Minnesota's largest employers, employing almost 500,000 workers across the state. Healthcare availability, access, and equity are incredibly important to our members, and I'd like to express our concerns regarding House File 3700. The circumstances that contribute to a hospital service line closure are predictable, but the arrival of those circumstances at a particular hospital are not. Increasing the notification period to the Department of Health from the current requirement of 120 days is unworkable. While a hospital can be forced to drop a service line due to financial challenges, it can also be the result of a shortage of specialized healthcare providers and, more broadly, the workforce crisis that healthcare is facing. For instance, it's impossible to predict the year when a town's birth rate will fall below a sustainable rate for employing a team of OB physicians. The timing of a specialty physician's move, retirement, or transition to part-time is not usually known until the physician gives their notice. And simply increasing the amount of days required for a hospital to give notice of a service line closure is an unworkable mandate on hospital systems that are already facing operational challenges while continuing to deliver care to their patients. We know the significant challenges our hospitals, and specifically rural hospitals, are facing. Demographics, economics, and geography can all work against the sustainability of rural healthcare. But pinpointing exactly when those conditions will create a crisis for a particular hospital is not possible, and House File 3700 puts greater pressure and uncertainty on an already unpredictable situation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. So that concludes the testimony. There is an amendment. Did anyone want to offer the amendment? This an A2-2 amendment. And just as a reminder, we adopted the author's amendment, the A1, which is also in your packets. Representative Nadeau.
I would move the A2-2.
Okay, to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Smith. Hopefully you've had time to, we talked about this on the floor last week, and you've had some time to look at this. And Madam Chair, what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to create a, you know, let me back up. I mean, what we say and how we say it, I think, is super important. And if I'm ever disrespectful, Madam Chair, I never mean to be, and please, you know, correct me. But, you know, I've heard here today talking about our hospitals as lumbering behemoths that slash services and drain the bottom line. And I think it's really important that we recognize that hospitals are a critical component to the coordination of care. I think it's important that we recognize that they literally stand alone in this thing where they're dealing with, you know, striving to find those payer mixes that allow them to be there. And Mary Krinke said, you know, hospitals don't want to close. They don't, that's like a tire store saying, I want to stop selling tires. They don't want to close. So what my amendment does, Madam Chair, is pretty simple, and hopefully Representative Smith will like some of these, maybe, hopefully all of them. On line 4, line 16, I'm basically deleting must and insert and putting in may. And what that has to do with is it allows the commissioner to impose that very large penalty. They may impose. I mean, let's say that, that a hospital, you know, all of a sudden at 182 days, and thank you for that amendment. I think that's great. At 5 days later, you know, creates a corrective plan. There is no relief that a hospital can seek. And if they happen to not notify now the 7 or the 19 new postings, I mean, if it's just the 7 entities that they're supposed to notify, I mean, that could be a fine for up to $140,000 that no, there is no relief. It is. The commissioner doesn't have an option. The hospital doesn't have an option. And it's a problem. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to, you know, make it a little bit more permissive. Nobody wants our hospitals to close. No one wants notification not to be addressed. So what my amendment does is it basically says that a commissioner may impose that penalty. It goes on to say, and it delineates now, each failure to a failure in notification, which would limit the overall, my intent of this amendment is to limit the fine for not notifying to $20,000 completely. It takes out the vague language, and maybe it was intended to be this way, so maybe it's not vague. To me, it's a little bit vague because I can't tell if that $20,000 would be imposed 19 times. If it would be or more than that, I just don't know. So that's my amendment, and I would really hope that we could get some support on this.
Okay, I have a couple of other people on list. Representative Keel, I assume you wanted to speak to the bill, not the amendment. Okay, Representative Backer, did you want to speak to the amendment?
I would. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And one of the challenges, I think this, what Representative Nadeau is doing makes sense, because in the area in greater Minnesota, I know our hospitals want to do everything that they can. There's no hospital that has a capacity to know within 300 days. So this makes it much more reasonable, not so challenging for our critical access hospitals. So I like this amendment. This makes sense. So thank you, Representative.
Representative Smith.
Yeah. Chair, Representative Nadeau, thank you so much for our discussion. And this is being laid over, so there's more discussion. I am going to ask for a no on this amendment, and I'll go through the reasons why. One is, just to be very clear, I hope the fine in this House file is never given, right? The hope is that hospitals will abide by the clear rules, I think, set out of who should be notified and what should be included in those notifications. So that's the goal. I would argue that each failure to notify is a separate wrong, or maybe we don't want to use a moral judgment, but a breaking of what we want hospitals to do. Just as an example, some of the things that are specified, that public officials, both of the city council, the county, and the Board of Health need to be notified. I think a lack of notification to any of those entities is a wrong thing that should be fined. Same thing as local health departments. Same thing as written notice to employees to notify where they should do. So I do think each of these breaking of this particular code is worthy of a fine, which is why I wouldn't want to just keep it all under one, that they could break as many of these as they want, but it's just one fine. Secondly, I would like to specify, because there's a couple things said by some of our testifiers concerning a loss of specialty staff. There are exemptions that are in the law right now that this is not going to change. It's not in the bill because I'm not changing it, but Subdivision 1C talks about those very situations where a specialized staff is no longer available, retires, takes another job somewhere else. The things that are required of a hospital in my bill will not apply in those exemption situations. So there is still a system for them to be exempted from this process in those extenuating circumstances. So you can look more on that subdivision if you would like. Finally, I would say to the must part of this, part of the desire of this bill and intent of this bill is to have hospital systems be compliant with letting the public know and bringing some transparency to this. And this is not a unique thing in our code. Just one example, in 144A.02 subdivision 6, if you receive a notice of noncompliance in a nursing home, there is a requirement that a fine accompany that noncompliance. So it's elsewhere in the law that we have these ideas that if you break it, you must receive a fine of some kind. And the idea is that that will be a deterrent, and this fine will not be imposed. So I think that's a response to that amendment.
All right. So moving to a vote then on the amendment, The Representative Nadeau is moving the A2-2. All in favor, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no.
No.
The motion does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted. So to the bill as previously amended, and just a reminder, the bill is going to be laid over. And just to say, too, that I think given some of the discussion, and I think Representative Smith has been showing that he's willing to continue working on the bill. By laying it over, some work can continue on it, clearly. Mm-hmm. So anyway, first on the list is Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to be a little confused here. First of all, the first testifier that you we allowed to have last meeting is from Foston, which happens to be in my district. And the challenges were promise of OBGYN services that they have been able to not been able to contract. So the conversation about just not getting it there, and I know that the community was upset about it, but the 120 days, DHS did not respond till well after the 120 days to have a public conversation. And when they did do that, it was done by way of Zoom or Teams. And unfortunately, the community had gotten together in a city council area, and DHS assumed that it was only the mayor and the administrator that were on that call, when in fact the room was full of quite a few testifiers. But not physically being in Foston, Minnesota, which I understand is a ways from St. Paul, was unfortunate in that hearing that they could not hear from the people that were there. And I know they're frustrated, but that 120 days was not acknowledged. So first of all, I wonder, I appreciate the 180 days, but what will make that happen? The hospital requested the hearing, the city requested the hearing, and the rules were not followed. So that put Foston in a predicament right there with their own, and they own the hospital. Essentia provides the services. But so what would you have to respond to that, Representative Smith?
Representative Smith.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think this bill is meant to address those sorts of situations, not just accountability, I think, for the hospital systems, but also for, as you mentioned, DHS, to make sure that this is a priority for them to make sure.
And Representative Smith, I believe this is MDH. This is the health department, not DHS. I see the DHS folks in the back going,
right.
Not us.
I'm thinking ahead of what I'm saying. Yeah, correct. Sorry. You are absolved.
Thank you for being corrected.
I guess what my answer to that would be, to keep that accountability both ways would be the ideal intent of this bill.
Thank you. Representative Keel.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my comment is, I really struggle. I wish we would have agreed to the amendment. I really struggle with our small hospitals, because I believe that as we have such a difficult time putting somebody in those services in our critical access hospitals, we're going to end up closing them. They certainly can't afford the $20,000 fine that they didn't have any intention of getting to begin with. They work their literal rear ends off to make sure that we have the services that are provided in rural Minnesota, and the distance that we have to go. Personal situation in one of my own clinics, where my parents actually had a physician that had a stroke, and his services ended that day. He didn't, unfortunately, get the privilege of being able to walk 2 weeks after he was, like I did. He was not able to provide services at all. So they had to scramble to replace the clientele, the patients with doctors. And I can see that happening in other areas where somebody gets sick or something changes. And the critical access hospitals are going to be fined because they didn't have that service, or somebody wasn't there. And this is an internal
specialist doctor. This wasn't even an OBGYN or psychology or any of those things. So we really struggle in rural Minnesota, and I know it's difficult in the cities, but folks, you guys still can get to another hospital without driving 2-3 hours. I mean, my largest hospital is 85 miles away at least, and that's a helicopter ride. God willing, you make it there. So I have some real concerns about 3700, even though I know for Foston this was appealing and they're frustrated with what's going on. So my comment, like I said, I'm really in a quandary, but we have to find a way to help both our citizens, our patients, our local communities, our businesses, and our hospitals. They are so vitally important to rural Minnesota. Thank you.
Okay, so we're really short on time. We're going to lay this bill over, just a reminder, everybody. So I'm going to go to New Brindley, Quam, Murphy, and then Schumacher, and then we're going to lay the bill over and go to the next bill, because we have a lot of people in the room who want to testify on the next bill. Oh, Representative Nadeau, I'll put you in there too, but please, everybody, be brief. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two quick questions. I'll ask them at the same time. Number one, on all of the notice requirements, most of them are pretty clear. However, a couple of them are quite vague. On lines 3.5 and 3.6, it is written notice which must be distributed to local and statewide media outlets. And typically, when we have notice requirements like that, it's to a paper of record or something along those lines. What does this include? Does this include every local radio station? Is it TV stations? Is the Pioneer Press considered statewide media? Is it a paper of record in a county? Or is it, how broad does this need to go? Who are we addressing here? And number two, my second question would be, you know, you just said that this bill is intended to hold MDH accountable as well. Now, there are obviously state-run hospitals where I don't see an exemption where it looks like this would apply to the state direct care and treatment hospitals. But I don't see anything in the bill that would indicate that there's any responsibility or accountability to MDH for the example that, like, say, Representative Keel gave. So if you could point us to that language, too, that would be helpful. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Two real quick answers. One is, Chair, and to, if you'd like to work on that language about, you know, media of record, we can just certainly do that. I'm willing to talk about that. I think the reason we put it there is because in a lot of these rural places, important sources of information might not by the state be considered a major media of record, but is important for those local communities. So I think that's why we left it vague. If we'd like to tighten it up, I'm willing to do that. And again, like specify that, I also wanted to say this to Representative Keel's question. This does not cover a situation where a specialized group can't be hired. There is an exemption for that. Again, Subdivision 1C of that is 144.55 Subdivision 1C. Gives those exemptions, and this is not changing that at all. So there wouldn't be fines imposed in those situations.
Okay.
Madam Chair, that didn't answer the question about what language will hold MDH accountable if they're not doing the things they're required to do, like holding the public hearing in time.
Representative Smith.
I mean, the law as it is written is to instruct them to do that. So, I mean, I'm not going to put a fine in for a government agency. So the expectation is they will do it.
Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, if you look at the language that is in, you know, local government and et cetera, local governments have to have a certain requirement for notification to their area. I think that if you're looking for language, you might as well be consistent with that, because that's aimed at those in greater Minnesota getting a hold of the people that need to know. And so you that would save you some time plagiarizing that section for language. I am very, I guess, disappointed, because you've got 4 months and the idea is, well, we're going to add another 62 days. Why don't we look at
having things taken care of in a timely fashion in that 4 months, because there is not a lot of wealth in these hospitals. They're very fiscally challenged. And as been stated, this is not an easy thing for them to do. So let's get it set up so that the bureaucrats actually get off out of their desk, come down locally, and do the service to the people there in a timely fashion. And I don't see this bill addressing that part. And so, frankly, instead of saying, well, we're going to extend the date, which adds to the amount of time of bleeding financially, or the issue of you don't have the personnel, so now you're hiring someone to cover that and paying twice the hourly rate, et cetera. Actually do the bill so that it gets done in that 4 months instead of, doing a hammer to the hospital and the people are trying to provide service. I see a misdirection in this bill. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, but I'd like to start out with just a couple of concerns. I mean, in rural Minnesota, the hospitals that I work with have very low margins, and they're competing every day to try to make sure that they can stay in business. You look at your collective fines, that definitely is going to be a hardship on these hospitals that are operating at extremely low margins. And then the added cost, just because you're forcing compliance to hire people, to go out and do things when they're not in a position to make money. It's not an income stream for them anymore. And then just the mandated forced compliance for profit businesses, you're really picking winners and losers. So my question to you is, do you see the potential for rural Minnesota hospitals to close under this under your bill?
Representative Smith.
No, nothing in this bill will be triggered unless there is going to be a closure already taking place.
So, Madam Chair?
Representative Murphy.
Do you think if a for-profit business is operating it under their margin, under the margin or low margin, they wouldn't consider closing?
Representative Smith.
I don't want to comment on how hospitals are run or if this bill specifically takes place after a decision has been made to close. So this does not factor into the earlier decision-making process.
Just in final, I think all these added costs.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in closing for my part, I mean, I'm a small business. If you put enough mandates on me, I don't have any choice. Either I'm going to operate as for-profit or I'm not going to make profit and I'm going to close. I see this as a real problem for rural Minnesota hospitals.
Representative Nadeau, and then Schumacher, and then we're done.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm sorry that my amendment didn't work. I think it would have allowed me to at least continue to work on this bill. This bill isn't a deterrent. This is a punitive attack on the 139 hospitals in Minnesota that are struggling to get by. Specifically in section 4. In section 6, 4.24 to 4.30, basically offering to sell this thing to a local unit of government. I mean, I get it. What a wonderful idea. But, I mean, you can't even buy, a municipality can't even buy a phone exchange in their small community without having 65% of the people in that district taking a vote. I just don't think this is, I think it's punitive. I think it's mean-spirited. I think this is not going to increase access or affordability of care. I think it's pulling out a member of the collaborative that helps, provide that service. And I do hope you work on it. I hope you lay this over and you bring all the members to the table on this thing, because right now this is going to harm Minnesotans.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two quick questions. First, on line 4.6, when we're looking for the telephone number and the address of the people posting, I just want to confirm that when we're talking about the chief executive officer, that we're talking about their work address and phone number and not their personal. And so if I could just get that confirmed, and then the status of a fiscal note. That's all. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Representative Schumacher, I think that Representative Smith took that line out with his previous
Correct.
Amendment.
Correct. The A1 amendment took that out. Struck the whole 4.6 line.
Okay, and then as far as fiscal note, Mr. Byrd?
Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, there is a pending fiscal note request on this bill with the A1 amendment.
All right, so we're laying the bill over, obviously. Okay, thank you. Representative Smith, closing comment, brief comment?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. I'm willing to continue to work on this. It is a bipartisan bill in the Senate. I hope it can be in the House. Maybe the final thing I would say is there's been a lot of talk about how this would affect the hospitals. I also think we need to say how this would affect patients. The reason we settled initially on 300 days is thinking of birthing centers that no family in rural Minnesota or any Minnesota would find out they were having a baby and then very quickly find out that their closest birthing center is going to close imminently. The reason we chose to shrink it to 182 is because that's two trimesters, to try to give those people more time to adjust to this very, very difficult decision. So that, I think a word needs to say to that. Thank you so much, Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Representative Smith. So with that, House File 3700, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. So now we're going to take up Representative Cha's bill, House File 2177. And just so members know, we can go a little bit over today, so we may do that because we have a lot of folks who want to testify on this bill. And so, Representative Cha, welcome to the committee. So I'm going to move that House File 2177 be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce, Finance, and Policy. And as we get going today, I just want to say that, first of all, this bill, obviously there's significant interest in this bill, and we have a lot of people who want to testify. We really need to limit the testimony to 2 minutes. I hope everyone will really help us in doing that. If we go over, I will have to stop you. I don't want to have to do that. So please monitor yourselves. The other thing is that this is the Health Committee. There's significant commerce discussion that goes on around this bill. That discussion should happen in the Commerce Committee where the bill is going. So we should limit our discussion today to this committee's jurisdiction, which is the health issues around the bill. So I hope we can do that. And I understand there is an author's amendment, an A1 amendment, to put the bill in the order in which Representative Cha would like to have it discussed, and looks like that just changes the date. So I will move the A1 amendment. All in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So, Representative Cha, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Leland, Vice Chair Bierman, and Minority Leader Schumacher, and members of this committee. I want to thank former Representative Helveston and Representative Frazier for the predecessors of this bill. Today in committee, I came down here, I brought something with me. Three of the most important things in my life. A photograph of my three daughters. I want to start this bill by talking a little bit about my daughter. And due to the essence of time, I'll keep it short and get right to the bullet points. And continue with my, let's see here. These are, it's a pleasure of testimony that my daughter gave to me, but I'm just going to get to the bullet point. Dad, I budgeted vaping before my food supply ration, my daily necessity supplies that I needed. I lost a lot of weight, Dad, because I was never hungry, because I was always vaping. It made me depressed. I was resentful. I was alone. I was scared, isolated. Without my vape, I felt naked. I felt abandoned, Dad. My mornings can start without vaping. And my life was on pause. I didn't realize I was addicted until I tried to quit. That's my daughter. Today I'm presenting House File 2177, a crucial measure aimed at eliminating all flavored tobacco products from the Minnesota market, including menthol cigarettes, flavored cigarettes, e-cigarettes, and shisha. This bill is not new. It's undergone multiple hearings over the past few years, has been enacted successfully in 29 Minnesota communities. It was widespread support with 62% of residents and 68% of the African-American backing the prohibition of flavored tobacco products in the state of Minnesota. The urgency behind this legislation is clear. The tobacco industry relentlessly targets our youth. This targeting of youth with flavored products is concerning because it can lead to nicotine addiction and lifelong health consequences. One in seven 11th grade students report the news of vaping e-cigarettes. And over 80% of youth who try tobacco start with flavored products. I refuse to stand by while tobacco industry profits off our children's health and future. It's time to send a clear message. The safety and future of Minnesota youth are non-negotiable. Safeguarding Minnesota's youth takes precedent over big tobacco companies. And with that, I would like to open up for the testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Cha. Okay, first on the list, I have Gene Nichols, followed by Daquan Epolite, and Gail Brotman, and then Michael Perez. So I'm reading the list so that you can all get ready to come down when it's your turn, and we can move fairly quickly through this. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Liebling, committee. My name is Eugene Nichols. I live in Shoreview, Minnesota. And I'm here representing in Minnesota for a smoke-free generation, a coalition of 50-plus organizations that share a common goal of advancing justice by striving towards a future where every person is free from commercial tobacco's harm and can reach their full health potential. I am also a member of the Menthol Coalition, a group of advocates fighting for the specific problem of menthol in the community, especially the black community. Ending the sale of menthol cigarettes and all flavored products will improve health outcomes, diminish disparities, and decrease health care costs, ultimately fostering a healthier and more equitable Minnesota for all. For more than 60 years, the tobacco industry has deliberately targeted black communities with marketing for menthol cigarettes. In the 1950s, only 5% of black people who smoked used menthol cigarettes. Today, it's nearly 88%. The staggering increase is not happenstance or the pure result of personal choice. It is the inevitable consequence of a powerful industry's relentless efforts to target and profit off the health of lives of people. Growing up in New York, we were affected by the free cigarettes that were given out. Free cigarette vans were strategically located in the Bronx and Harlem, New York City, near social services offices and iconic locations like the Apollo Theater. Receiving his first cigarette in this fashion, my brother started smoking at the age of 15 as a result of that, and he succumbed to COPD after 54 years of smoking menthols. I miss my brother Jimmy. This kind of silent suffering must end. But this isn't an issue of the past. It still happens today. We see it in deliberate marketing of new technologies that addict all users. So is it any wonder that African Americans have the highest death rates and shorter survival rates for most cancers and heart and lung diseases? We can't wait another year to pass House File 2177. Every year we do nothing, more families experience the pain and suffering I had with my brother Jimmy. Please vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Daquan, and please, you'll tell me how you say your last name. And then after that, Gail Brotman and Michael Perez. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Liebling and committee members. My name is Daquan Epelite, and I am here from Rochester to express my strong support and belief for House File 2177. I have been working on the vaping epidemic for the last 2 years, first being involved with EPIAC, a Rochester-based youth program focused on ending the sales of vaping. Now I consult with the American Lung Association, and I sit on the Mayor Norton's Youth Advisory Commission, where I work on bettering Rochester and Olmsted County. This includes addressing commercial tobacco and vaping in hopes of stopping persuasive problems caused by fruit, candy, and menthol-flavored cigarettes. Now, all of you guys have the booklet I have right here. This is only one small percentage that all the youths have. This is a voice from all the youths that, well, not all, but some of the youths that are infected. Tens of thousands of kids per year are falling victim to vaping. My generation is not the first to fall victim to these lies presented by Big Tobacco. These products contain an overabundant amount of nicotine and chemicals, and they are designed to mask the ugly truth. My generation has never seen flavored cigarettes because the FDA has took them out. But menthol cigarettes were left out, creating a loophole at the expense of Minnesotans, especially targeted towards minorities. They found a new way to hook a generation into a lifetime of addiction. We cannot wait another year to pass House File 2177. By the next session, thousands of Minnesotans will become addicted. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, Gail Brotman, Michael Perez, Colleen O'Neill, Namad Khalif. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Liebling and committee members. My name is Dr. Gail Brotman, and I have been working to help children breathe easier for over 30 years. I am the Director of Pediatric Pulmonary Medicine at Hennepin County Medical Center, as well as an Associate Professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Minnesota. We all hear about the impact of smoking on adults causing lung cancer, emphysema, heart attacks, and strokes. But from my perspective as a pediatric pulmonologist, I see the impact that smoking and nicotine have on children and young people every day. We are experiencing an e-cigarette epidemic among our children. As you've heard, over 35% of high school students reported that they have ever used an e-cigarette, and among those students who currently use tobacco, 84% of high school and 62% of middle school students either use menthol or other flavored products. These devices deliver ultrafine particles deep into the lungs that impact the developing brain and are dangerous to lung health by causing ongoing airway inflammation. I have seen the harm of youth vaping in my practice with children hospitalized in the pediatric intensive care unit from respiratory failure from vaping. Sadly, even after being in the hospital on respiratory support, they struggled to stop vaping due to their nicotine addiction. Some may talk about e-cigarettes as harm reduction, and that flavored e-cigarettes can be used for quitting. These products are highly addictive and come in flavors that are attractive to children. Moreover, the flavors themselves contain chemicals that are harmful to lungs. Let me be clear. E-cigarettes are not approved by the FDA for quitting, and we have a whole new generation of young people becoming addicted to these products. How is that reducing harm? This is an urgent health issue. We can't wait another year to pass HF 2177. As leaders, you can protect children's health by voting yes to ending the sale of all flavored tobacco products. And Madam Chair, if I may, as a healthcare provider and a lung specialist, I heard the testimony about insulin earlier, and I have to tell you all that the cost of all medications, inhalers, including insulin, is out of control. And I think that any opportunity to limit the cost of life-saving medication by this committee needs to be taken up.
We got to stick to the topic before us, but thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, next testifier, Michael Perez, Colleen O'Neill, Namad Khalif, and then Chief Kelly McCarthy. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair members. Nice to meet you. My name is Michael. I'm 13. I live in St. Paul. I'm from Leech Lake in Guatemala. Acema, or tobacco, was given to us by the Creator as a sacred medicine for Native people. We use it in traditional ways like offering it before we use or take something. or to thank elders for sharing their wisdom. This has always been our way. Unfortunately, big tobacco has worked its way into my culture. There is nothing natural or native about Native American spirit cigarettes. In my classroom, I see students that use vapes to manage their stress and calm down. Older high school students also use cigarettes. I see people my age using vapes and commercial tobacco to manage their anxiety or stress. I wish more kids from my community would use traditional tobacco and other sacred medicines when they are struggling. We can't wait another year to pass House File 2177. Every year, we do nothing. More kids like me are damaging their health and lungs as they become dependent on the products. Please vote yes. Our health depends on it.
Thank you for your testimony. Colleen O'Neill. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, Chair and committee members. My name is Colleen O'Neill. I'm a licensed alcohol and drug counselor. I provide support around substance use for the Mounds View School District, primarily secondary schools. Every day, I help students and families navigate challenges related to substance use. In my work, I have found that the leading reason I meet with middle school students is due to vaping nicotine. I can also share that a vast majority of high school students I meet with vape nicotine as well as use other substances. Nearly all the students I see are using flavored cigarettes, e-cigarettes. Most students say they probably would not have used a vape if the nicotine was not flavored. I brought some examples of one of my high schools in 1 month of vapes that were confiscated. We don't have the vapes that weren't confiscated. Unfortunately, most students don't realize they're struggling with addiction. They view vaping as a coping mechanism for stress and other mental health challenges. Once they realize they are addicted, I do everything I can to help them overcome immense challenges and get off the wheel of addiction. This is incredibly difficult, time-consuming, and at times challenging due to the complexities of addiction. School administrators throughout Minnesota are stretched thin and challenged to meet the needs of our students on both an educational and emotional level. I firmly believe that if we could eliminate flavors, we would see fewer students begin to vape and more students realizing the need for support to help them quit. Minnesota is leading the way in supporting our kids through landmark programs like the Universal School Meals Law that passed last session. Ending flavored tobacco sales is a great next step to keeping our kids healthy, ready to learn, and prepared for the future. We can't wait another year to pass HF 2177. Every year we do nothing, we leave schools standing on a beach with an umbrella in the middle of a tsunami. We also leave our young people at risk for future addiction if we don't do something about this now. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. So to speed things up, just go ahead, please. Representative Shaw, I'm going to ask you to maybe sit in the back there or just right behind you, and then I'm going to ask two testifiers to come up at a time so that the one who's on deck will be sitting at the table. So I'm like, next one is Namad Khalif and then Police Chief Kelly McCarthy. Please both come up. And then following that will be Reverend Dr. Charles Gill, followed by Thomas Briant. So I'm going to ask you both to come up at the same time. So Namad Khalif, if I'm saying your name right, welcome to the committee.
Hi, my name is, first of all, good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Namad. I am a freshman at the University of Minnesota. And I want to share my strong support for this bill and want to add one piece to the conversation today. I've seen the impact that two tobacco products, in particular, e-cigarettes and hookah, have had on my friends and loved ones. Unfortunately, many young people wrongly perceive using e-cigarettes or hookah as somehow safer than smoking cigarettes. This is just not true, but my generation has received a lot of misleading information about these products from the tobacco industry. Some may assume that we need to exempt flavored hookah because it's culturally important to the East African communities. As a member of this community, I want you to know that hookah is not unique to any community or culture, but it is becoming increasingly common among young people from many different backgrounds. And most of these young people are not using hookah for cultural reasons. It is communities like mine that get left behind when policies get watered down. And of course, black people aren't the only ones hurt by menthol and flavored products. They're popular among all demographics, including Latinx, Hmong, LGBTQ+, and yes, also rural Minnesotans. We can't wait another year to pass House File 2177. Every year we do nothing, more people become addicted and communities like mine get left behind.
All right, thank you for your testimony. So, and then Chief Kelly McCarthy, and then I'm going to ask Dr. Charles Gill to come down. So you could step away and the next person comes down, and that way we fill in and keep going. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kelly McCarthy, and I'm the current police chief of the city of Mendota Heights, Mendota, and Lilydale, and I'm here today to urge you to support House File 2177. In 2018, Mendota Heights was the first community outside of California to pass an ordinance that banned flavored commercial tobacco products, including menthol. And as police chief, I fully supported this policy initiative because it was a crucial strategy in reducing the number of young people using these dangerous nicotine products in our community and an important step to advance and build momentum in Minnesota towards broader adoption of this vital public health measure. The Comprehensive Flavors Ordinance in Mendota Heights, as well as House File 2177, does not criminalize the purchase, use, or possession of flavored tobacco for individuals, and it aligns with Tobacco 21 laws and 28 other local licensing ordinances in Minnesota that either restrict or prohibit the sale of flavored tobacco. Our ordinance was successfully implemented in our community, and we worked hand in hand with our retailers to ensure a smooth transition and encourage their voluntary compliance. Minnesota has long been at the forefront of tobacco prevention policies, with a significant portion of our population already covered by local policies that restrict the sale of flavored and or menthol tobacco efforts or products. Despite our efforts, the tobacco industry persists in targeting Minnesota's youth and others through deceptive marketing practices, and there's still much work to be done. This bill addresses critical issues that are of paramount importance to our community and countless others across Minnesota. In fact, in your packet, you received a letter from local officials from cities across Minnesota asking you to support this bill. Every year we do nothing. Minnesotans that live in our community without local policies will continue to be lured into addiction by menthol, candy, and fruit flavors. It is time for our state to act, and please support House File 2177 to create a healthier future for everyone in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, and I'm going to ask Thomas Briant to come down and take the other seat. And please... Dr. Gill, go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Liebling and the members of the committee. My name is Reverend Charles Gill. I'm the senior pastor of Pilgrim Baptist Church right here in St. Paul, Minnesota. It has been long known that the tobacco industry values profits over people. Money motivates the tobacco industry to aggressively lobby for laws that do more for their own pockets than for the well-being of citizens. To quote the NAACP, the tobacco industry is on a narrow quest for profit, and they have been killing us along the way. This policy is supported by a wide range of black organizations, scientists, and elected officials. These supporters include members of the Congressional Black Caucus, the NAACP, and other black civil rights and health organizations. It also includes 100 Black Men of America Incorporated, the United States Conference of Mayors, and over 300 faith leaders from across this country, including myself and others that are right here in this room today. Contrary to the claims made by the tobacco industry, black voters overwhelmingly support this policy. That brings to mind the audacity of the tobacco industry, which claimed that ending the sale of menthol tobacco would hurt African Americans by increasing incidents of police harassment. That very claim exploits the real issue of police brutality and mass incarceration just to protect their bottom line. Let me be clear. HF 2177 does nothing to criminalize individuals addicted to these products. However, the penalties for selling menthol cigarettes will fall on the industry, not on black Minnesotans who choose to smoke. Chair Liebling and members of the committee, we can't wait another year to pass HF 2177. Every year that we do nothing, we stand by as an industry continues to put profit over people.
Thank you for your testimony. And then I'm going to ask Frank Orton to come down, and our next testifier is Thomas Brandt. Please welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Thomas Bryant, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association. I'm here to speak in opposition to House File 2177. House File 2177 would prohibit the sale of tobacco products which the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has specifically found to be, quote, appropriate for the protection of the public health. Let me explain. Under the 2009 Federal Tobacco Control Act, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration was authorized to regulate the manufacture, distribution, and sale of all tobacco products. For a tobacco product that was introduced into the market after February 15th of 2007, the manufacturer must submit a pre-market tobacco application to the FDA. The agency then conducts an extensive scientific review of accepted applications and determines whether to authorize or decline the future marketing of the product. To find that a product can be marketed, the FDA must determine that the product is appropriate for the protection of the public health. To date, the FDA has issued marketing orders authorizing the sale of 45 tobacco and electronic nicotine products because they met this protective public health standard. Some of these products have flavors such as menthol, mint, or wintergreen. I submitted the list of 45 with my testimony to the committee, and I have others if you need them. As I stated, House File 2177 would prohibit the sale of these federally authorized flavored products, but doing so would be detrimental to the public who want alternatives for their tobacco addiction. In addition, the FDA is waiting for the Biden administration to issue a final decision this month on proposed regulations that would ban the sale of menthol cigarettes and all flavored cigars nationwide. The Minnesota legislature should allow the Biden administration to finalize action on these proposed regulations before taking any state legislative action. Finally, prohibiting the sale of flavored tobacco products will not reduce the demand for such products. If flavored tobacco is banned in Minnesota, Minnesotans could purchase flavored tobacco products on Native American reservations here in the state, in the four adjacent states which allow flavored products to be sold on the Internet or from unregulated illicit sellers who will sell to anyone of any age who has cash. For these reasons, Madam Chair and members, I urge you to oppose House File 2177. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And so next will be Frank Orton and then Clay Lambert. So if Clay Lambert could make your way down. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Frank Orton with Orton Oil Company. We're a small family-owned business of 15 convenience stores in northern Minnesota, two of which should operate on border communities of East Grand Forks and Moorhead, Minnesota. We've seen firsthand that these types of bans do nothing but shift the purchase to the adjacent states. This position of the state of Minnesota will do nothing more than do that statewide, and as alluded to previously, there is federal movement on it. I think there's also been a bit of a muddying of the waters here in a lot of directions. First and foremost, we talk a lot about e-cigarettes. We're forgetting about one of the main areas here, which is chewing tobacco, Grizzly Wintergreen, Skoal Mint. Most, many contractors, tradespeople use these products. They're legal adults that understand those. They're our number one selling SKU in our convenience stores in that area. At the same time, in the state of Minnesota, we allow other substances to be sold, alcohol to be one, most recently THC and marijuana that has flavors. You can certainly go into any liquor store and buy multiple types of vodka with various blueberry, grape, strawberry, any flavor you want, but we're not looking to get rid of those. In terms of the kids, and I have three sons myself, 12, 14, and 16, I'm hospitable to those arguments 100%. We've recently raised the age to buy to 21. We're responsible retailers. We not only get stings on ourselves through the bars program every single month at every single location that we own, we get county and FDA stings at our locations as well. As an industry, we score very, very high in those. We are responsible retailers. So I think there's a few things here that we need to parse through. Removing Grizzly Wintergreen would be like going to the liquor industry and saying, we're done with Busch Light and Coors Light. That's how commonplace that chewing tobacco is. I want to make sure everybody understands when you're talking about bubblegum-flavored e-cigarettes that that's mixed in this as well. In closing, I think it's better served to be handled at the federal level and that we need to be mindful of the mainstream products that grown adults choose to use, even though it may be detrimental to their own health. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And the next person to come down to the table would be Yasir, and I don't even want to try the last name, and you'll hopefully tell me when you get here. But welcome to the committee, Mr. Lambert.
Madam Chair, committee, thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Clay Lambert, and I own a gas station, convenience store, tobacco store in Minneapolis. I think what's going to happen today is most people are going to talk about some of the things here, but I'm going to talk about myself. In addition to being a business owner, I'm a former smoker who made an informed choice regarding my health implications of smoking. I understood the risk, and I took up smoking, and likewise, I recognize the health benefit. I recognize the health benefits available to me upon quitting. What's different in my story compared with the HF 2177 is that I made a personal choice, not a government mandate, to quit. It's essential to acknowledge that many smokers have transitioned to alternatives like vape products for similar reasons, and these products offer less harmful options. While I do not assert that vaping is entirely risk-free, reputable sources like the Public Health of England and other public health bodies have found vaping to be at least 95% safer than combustible cigarette products. Banning these products undermines the health reduction efforts and may push former smokers back to harmful habits. Something that happened a few years ago was the industry or the government came after us as retailers and said that we were harming young people by the selling vapes. And what it came out to be was that the young people were manipulating the device itself and putting in their own things, and that's what came out to be. It's important that this stuff is manufactured properly, it's administered properly, it's sold properly through us. What's going to happen is it's going to go, I'm in Minneapolis, I see it sold everywhere, underground, everything. A statistic I saw this morning, 73 million packs of cigarettes were sold illegally in the state of Minnesota last year. I'm floored by that because we sell a lot of cigarettes and I don't really see that part of it. So it's my sincere belief that the bill will create winners and losers in the business landscape without substantially impacting public health. I respectfully urge you to consider a balanced approach, taking into account both the public health goals that this committee prioritizes and the economic impacts on local businesses like me. Thank you.
Thank you. And just everyone remembers the economic impact on business is kind of the next committee, although obviously there's crossover of members. Welcome to the committee. I'm going to ask the next person, Tom Madden, to come down. And then the next one on the list will be Joe Zirka. And we are going a little bit over, so just so members are aware. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Liebling, members of the committee. My name is Yasir Abualiga. I own a convenience store in Fridley and in Little Canada. Today, I stand before you as a business owner and a member of the Minnesota Service and Convenience Store Association to voice my opposition to HF 2177. Convenience stores and service stations have historically provided opportunities for immigrants, embodying the American dream. However, this bill threatens to end this dream. Flavored tobacco products, including menthol cigarettes and chewing tobacco, accounts for a huge percentage of our sales and foot traffic to our convenience stores. Such products are essential to the financial viability of my business. The proposed ban would drastically reduce our revenue, directly leading to the closure of my service station. I understand the concerns leading to this bill, but it's crucial to consider its consequences on small businesses owners like myself. The suggestion to turn to a dispensary for legal cannabis is not a viable possibility for my business. My faith strictly prohibits the sales or use of cannabis. By supporting this bill, you're not only affecting the availability of certain products, but also endangering the existence of business that community members rely on. This decision forces us to choose between our ethical beliefs and our survival. I urge you to reconsider the application of HF 2177 on the lives of businesses owners like myself. I have invested everything to the promise of this country. Let us find a balanced approach that addresses public health concerns without destroying the livelihood of hardworking individuals who contribute positively to this community. Also, there's a lot of health discussions today. Corn syrup on MSG is worse than tobacco. Maybe we should focus on that first. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in front of you today.
Thank you for your testimony. So Joe Zirkus should come down, and next is Tom Madden. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, my name is Tom Madden. I'm a small business owner in Minnetonka. I have a vape store, and Representative Atcombe, nice to see you. As you remember, we tried a flavor ban in Tonka years ago, and that was rejected harshly by the community, mainly with adult testimony saying how electronic cigarettes helped them quit smoking. As an owner of 12 years of a vape store, I can honestly say I've seen hundreds of adults we've helped quit smoking. Even at that meeting, we saw one of the city council members mention her father who quit smoking not because of the electronic cigarette but because of the mango flavor. There's a news flash. Smokers don't like the taste of cigarettes. They like the nicotine. At that same meeting, another proposal was to raise the age of e-cigarettes to 21 from 18. As a business owner, I was a huge fan of that proposal. These products should not be in the hands of any teenager in the state of Minnesota. Study after study has shown that vape stores do the best job of meticulously carding their customers at the age of 21. We have very few products. If we lose these products, we're out of business. If the goal is to remove the product out of the kids' hands, then let's restrict the sale to only vape stores. I myself have a 16-year-old and a 12-year-old son. Let's not confuse the e-cigarettes and analog cigarettes. Simply because they have the same name, they're entirely different products. That is the equivalency of comparing a grizzly bear to a teddy bear. They do not represent the same product line. E-liquid has been around since the year 2001, introduced into the United States in the year 2002. The groundbreaking study out of the United Kingdom, August of 2015, shows that 95% electronic cigarettes are 95% safer than analog cigarettes. This study goes back to 2015. It's been tested time and time again, and it continues to hold up the test of time. It is entitled Public Health of England, Electronic Cigarettes. I urge all of the committee here to look at that. England was in the 50s, was 10 years ahead of this country, telling the world that cigarettes will cause cancer. The U.S. turned our back, turned our eye, and it wasn't until 12 years later that we finally realized that cigarettes cause cancer. We need to wake up in this country and realize that electronic cigarettes are the way to help our community live healthier lives. Currently,
I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
Okay, I'll be quick. I'll make one last point. Okay. If the concern is the high level of nicotine in these products, to address the levels of it, we must also address the levels of caffeine. As any doctor will tell you, okay, Nicotine and caffeine are the same.
Yeah,
are the
I'm going to stop you right here. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Okay, only one more.
Okay, no,
we had a doctor go to over 3 minutes, but you cut me off at 2 minutes and 50 seconds.
We're all 2 minutes, sir. And
but that Dr. Brocken went 3 minutes and 1 second.
Paul Lamplin, please thank come down. Next is Joe Zirka.
Hi. I'm Madam Chair and members of the House Health Finance and Policy Committee. My name is Joe Zirka, and I'm the owner of Stop and Shop and A to Z Tobacco in Minneapolis. I'm here today to express my strong opposition to HF 2177, which seeks to ban all flavored tobacco products in the state of Minnesota. My businesses, which include a gas station convenience store opened in 1997 by my father and my uncle, and a tobacco store opened in 2018 before the menthol ban, were completely destroyed by the riots in May 2020. Both businesses were closed for 16 months, and I had to completely rebuild from the ground up. It was an extremely challenging journey, but in 2021, I was finally able to reopen my stores. Now HF 2177 threatens to destroy my businesses all over again and will result in having to let go of 17 employees, as my businesses will not survive this ban. This ban will not keep people from smoking flavored tobacco. They will still be able to find them in other places. You are creating a black market and creating more crime in our city. Turning people to buy their flavored tobacco products in unregulated places is definitely not in the interest of public health. With online retailers and criminals selling illicit products, who knows where that product is coming from or what's in it? Plus, they do not care about the age of the people they are selling to, which opens the door to more youth to access tobacco products. Instead of banning flavored tobacco products, I urge you to allow legitimate retailers in Minnesota, like me, to continue to sell them. My staff is very well trained in the age verification process, and we refuse to sell to anyone who is not at least 21 years old. For these reasons, I respectfully urge you to consider the negative impact of HF2177 and the unintended consequences it will have on public health. Please do not move forward with HF2177. Thank you for allowing me to speak with you today.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. And so the next one at the table will be Joe O'Connor, and that will be the last testifier. And welcome to the committee, Mr. Lampland.
Yes, my name is Paul Lampland. I thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for my testimony. I am a advocate for vapers and an employee and contractor in the industry. I'm here to voice my strong opposition to this bill, HF 2177. Flavored vaping products are sold exclusively by retail stores that only allow to 21 plus consumers. We are a highly regulated industry with federal and state enforcement. There is no need to further prevent or prohibit the use of these products. Flavored vapes and vaping were developed as a harm reduction solution for those who would like to quit the continued use of combustible tobacco products. Combustible tobacco is a much bigger threat, and the tax revenues from vaping products can be directed to the funding of cessation programs. The switch to vaping products is a healthier option to traditional smoking, and big tobacco would love to see that competition go away. It is true that nicotine is an addictive product. However, vaping has no nic and low nicotine options to wean smokers away from their addiction as an option to nicotine usage. Flavor options give choice to consumers. They should have the same rights that are offered to cannabis beverages or alcoholic beverages. I have not seen any rush to legislate alcoholic seltzers like the ones that resemble lemonade or Mountain Dew. Are they not targeting young adults? If so, why is there not the same vigor to abolish them? Because they are age-restricted, so are flavored vaping products. Education is needed on how this industry has replaced the unhealthy use of consuming traditional tobacco products and offered alternatives by creating so many options via flavors that appeal to a large segment of the population for smoking cessation away from combustible tobacco. Prohibition of these products only drives consumers to less regulated products and will proliferate in a black market that is unregulated by the FDA. Certainly, the idea that young adults are using vaping products, you know, the assumption that they're getting these products through the normal channels is just absolutely wrong.
I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
I implore the committee representatives not to take the position with the popular moral high ground stance that this HF 2177 bill, flavored vaping, is not equivalent to tobacco. It is a safer solution to quitting nicotine addiction. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. So Joe O'Connor, is he here? Okay, so I guess not. Okay, so that's the our testimony concludes. We are way over time, but Representative Chalk, sure, come on back. Thank you. And so we are going to have a little bit of member discussion, and Representative Huang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, a lot of things were touched on here about the full consideration of the distribution or and et cetera. But the curiosity I have is I've never smoked. And I know that there are some people that from their doctors are being told to do this and this to help quit smoking. If a doctor wished for certain vape products for a patient to use, would that be prohibited from this bill?
Representative Cha.
I'm yield that to Emily Anderson. Thank you.
Yeah, please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair Liebling, members of the committee. My name is Emily Anderson. I'm the Director of Policy at the Association for Non-Smokers Minnesota. Our organization is a member of the Minnesotans for a Smoke-Free Generation Committee. I will, to respond to the question, Chair Liebling, Representative Plum, the e-cig companies actually sued the FDA to not be considered cessation devices. That was back in 2010. What we do know is that Minnesotans can access free cessation that is FDA approved. Here in the state, they have access to cessation like gum, patch, lozenger, as well as free counseling. These are products that have been approved by the FDA for tobacco cessation and have gone through the rigorous FDA standards that are required for drugs on the market.
Just quickly, Madam Chair, I think it's silly and childish to assume that there aren't individuals that would respond better to some of these, and I don't care what the manufacturers say. I care what the doctor who knows the patient says, and I hope that we look at that impact. Thank you.
All right. Representative Doe, and then we're going to go to Representative Chopra. Very brief closing, and then we're going to vote on the bill. Representative Doe.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And the testifier, Emily, thanks for coming up there. My question is, we have 29 municipalities currently in Minnesota that have enacted a ban similar to this. Is there any evidence to suggest, has it been early long enough where we've actually, we can determine that a ban of this sort will reduce adolescent tobacco use?
Chair Liebling, Representative Netto. What we do know is that this is a best practice for tobacco prevention, that the Surgeon General actually said that prohibiting flavors, including menthol, will help public health by reducing initiation among young people and promoting cessation among adults. We also know that no one policy is the golden ticket for reducing tobacco use among all populations, that these policies work in concert with other policies such as Tobacco 21, which the legislature passed in 2020. And we do have evidence that in communities with policies that are well implemented and well enforced, including these flavor policies in the 29 Minnesota communities, that we're seeing rates, especially among young, initiation rates among young people decline.
All right. Thank you. Representative Cha, final short closing, and then we're going to vote.
Thank you, Chair. In closing, I want to stress that protecting kids from flavored tobacco products has long been a bipartisan support. I want to thank all the co-authors on this committee for their support, and the chair and vice chair and minority lead for hearing this bill. I want to leave us with one thing I want to share with all of you. Dad, last year when you decided to carry the House Bill File 2177, it gave me the courage I needed to quit smoking. I want to share with the committee that as of May 2023, I have been smoke-free. Ladies and gentlemen, there will be winners and losers in this bill. But the winners, I guarantee you, will be the youth and the future of Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Chan. Thank you to all of the testifiers. With that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2177, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce, Finance, and Policy. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you very much. And members, obviously, we're over time. We didn't get to some bills. We will reschedule them. We stand adjourned.